You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Initiation Science and the Development of the Human Mind. It is Collected Works, Volume 228. This is Part 5, entitled The Past, Present, and Future Development of the Human Mind. Lecture 6, given in Stuttgart on the 14th of September, 1923. The subject for the lectures I am going to give at this conference will be essential human nature as it has evolved, developed at a particular time in the past, as it is in the immediate present, and what the prospects for it are in future human evolution on planet Earth. With every promising philosophy of life that has flowed into Western civilization with its American appendage, the aim has been not only to consider the human being in the present age of humanity, pointing out how the individual appears in his place within the whole of humanity on Earth, but it has been a feature of the very philosophies which were likely to be accepted into Occidental civilization, that the human being was always also seen in the historical evolution of humanity on Earth, bringing the present-day human being together with the human being of the past, either up to a certain point, as in the Old Testament, or more as earthly history, or also higher up, including a study of planetary evolutions in the cosmos. This was not so much a feature of Oriental philosophies, nor of the earlier philosophies in Europe, insofar as they were not yet part of modern civilization. They limited themselves more to placing the human being in the given space, as it were. Because of the way we have been brought up being part of Occidental evolution, our sentience, our feelings, could not be satisfied with merely placing man in the world's physical space. We have a certain inner instinct which demands that we are together with our brothers, as it were, not only with the people of the present time in physical space, but also with the people of earlier times. For it is only together with the people of today and those of the future that they make up the whole human race. We will not gain a satisfactory view on this historical evolution of man in the narrower or wider sense if we consider only the external anthropological evidence. External documents, however cleverly interpreted, cannot encompass the evolution of man, for man has body, mind or soul, and spirit. The spirit has always shone through man, to a greater or lesser degree, so that conscious awareness has been living in him. And the evolution of the human mind really shows itself to be such that one can see the whole essence and nature of man in this unfolding of the mind. Just as with our senses, we are ultimately able to perceive the nature of the plant in its flower. Let us therefore consider this, the most important element in human evolution, the evolution of the human mind. If we look at the human mind today, we find that we can make the following distinction. In the ordinary waking state, in which we are from waking up until going to sleep, we develop a more or less clear, bright ability to form ideas. This grows from the depths of the life of feeling, as a flower does from the plant. Compared to the clear, bright life of ideas, the life of feeling is like something that is more or less half unconscious, dark, inwardly billowing and moving, and never being really entirely clear. Deeper down than our feelings, which do at least also give very direct impulses to our life in ideas, much further down, are then the will impulses. I have quite often spoken to anthroposophists that when it comes to the will impulses, human beings are essentially asleep, even in their waking hours. The principle that lives in the will impulses in the human being himself really does not at all come to conscious awareness in today's waking state. We have a notion that we are going to do one thing or another. That is not yet the will impulse. Within it lies the intention to have a will impulse, taking the form of an idea. The principle represented by this intention then goes deep down into our essential human nature, into depths that have no greater clarity for the mind than dreamless sleep. And it rises up again as will impulse, rises up in what our arms and hands, our legs and our feet are doing, things we do with the objects of the outside world. The things we thus do from will impulses in our own body, the changes we make to the outside world through our will impulses, come to conscious awareness because we form ideas, ideas also connected with feelings. In our ordinary state of consciousness, we have only the beginning and the end of the will impulse, the intention as an idea, and the observation of moving ourselves or moving things in the outside world as the consequence of our intentions. Anything in between, how our soul's intentions pour into the organism, how the soul stimulates body warmth, movement of the blood, of muscle, and so on, in order to become will impulse, all this remains as unconscious as do the elements of dreamless sleep. For it simply is the case that someone who is truly able to observe his experiences has to say to himself, quote, "I am really only awake when forming ideas. I dream in my feelings. I sleep in my will impulses." Close quote. And it really is nothing else with these will impulses but what happens when we wake up in the morning and realize that our organism has restored and refreshed itself in a particular way. We perceive the experiences of sleep as we wake up. We intend to do this or that. We also send our intentions unconsciously down into our organism. Their life is a life of sleep when they change into actions. And we only wake up again when we act and see the results of what has been going on inside us, but has been at an unconscious level. Those are the major elements, as it were, of human inner experience, when awake, when dreaming, when asleep. For the dreams we have at night, in sleep, have little connection with our life in ideas. They follow laws that differ completely from the logical laws of our life in ideas. Yet one is able to observe, if one goes into things, if one is able to do that, one will find that the course taken by dreams, this marvelous, dramatic progress they often follow, shows extraordinary similarity to our life and feelings. If we were able only to feel when awake, the feelings themselves would not be similar to the dream images, but their inner drama, tensions, relief, wish impulses, disasters of inner experiences that may wallow in feelings. They present to our feeling, with all the, quote, lack of definition, close quote, or if you like, definition one also gets with dreams, except that a dream lives in images, and our life of feeling in the characteristic experiences which we identify with terms of inner sentience in feeling. We may therefore see feeling and our actual dreaming as dream states in the present-day human mind, and the processes of will impulses and those of actual dreamless sleep as belonging to the present-day human being's sleep level of consciousness. We have to understand that the basic aspects of the conscious mind, as it is today, have not that long ago also gone through a process of development, a development which people prefer not to speak of in our present materialistic age. Yet we will no longer understand things that have come down to us as documents of human thought as early as the first Christian centuries, unless we are aware that something very different lived in the inner human being when he was thinking than lives in the inner soul today. And there is need to point out that it is downright ignorance in our souls to approach a work such as John Scotus Origena's title Periphysion, De Divisione Natura, or The Division of Nature, written in the 9th century, let us say, with the kind of life of ideas we have been brought up in, or the old books on alchemy. Today's way of thinking does not allow us to understand what was meant at that time. You read words and do not understand what people meant by them. From the 15th century onward, human thinking has borne a quite specific stamp. And although this developed slowly and gradually, it has, relatively speaking, already reached its high point today. This form of thinking, being the actual waking state in present-day human life, as I have shown, is really such that essentially present-day people cannot find happiness. People think that only their waking experiences have light and clarity. They think it is the only thing by means of which, drawing on their inner life, they also compose the most marvelous results in the sciences. Essentially, however, people do not find happiness at all with this present way of thinking to meet their inner longings, for they actually lose themselves in this present-day thinking. They lose themselves so that this thinking is the only clear content of the mind, much clearer than the blood circulation, for instance, or their breathing. Those remain dark and unclear in lower regions of the conscious mind. One feels that a reality lives in them, but one really sleeps through this reality and is awake only in forming ideas, in thinking. But particularly if one is a bit inclined, let us say, to practice self-reflection, one will find, quote, you are actually losing yourself in the thinking, which is really the only thing you have in your inner life, close quote. And there are two connections. I would say, this is of course meant to be a mental image, where this losing oneself in thought becomes quite tangible. A thinker of more recent times, Descartes, coined the modern phrase, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. Yes, those are the words of a philosopher. But people of more recent times do not say so, are unable to say so. They say, quote, when I merely think something, experience it in thought, it simply is not. And when I think myself, surely I am not. Such thoughts are at most images. It is the most certain thing in me. But I do not take hold of existence in my thinking. Close quote. People also say that something one is merely thinking is but a thought. Descartes, therefore, is desperately insisting, quote, one would wish to be, and nowhere else are there points of reference where we can grasp this being, this existence of man, in the thinking of more recent times. One is therefore looking for it in the very place where, according to general sentience, it definitely is not, in one's thinking. Close quote. Every sleep negates Descartes' words. We do not think in our sleep. Is it that then we are not? Do we die at night and are born again in the mornings? Or are we? Do we exist from going to sleep to waking up? The simplest truths do not take account of the views currently held in the world. Those words reflect a desperate clinging to something with one's being, quote, I think, therefore I am, close quote, and not any kind of inner experience. So that is one thing. The other connection we may refer to is this. Apart from our thinking, and modern people are very proud of it, we also have the findings of modern natural science, of observations, and the results of experiments. Well, yes, But the way they are is that they do not allow us to look into the actual being or existence of things, but only in the changes they undergo, into ephemera. In spite of this, modern man finds that a thought is only justifiable if it has been taken from this external kind of existence, which, however, only shows itself in its outer revelation. Modern man has therefore stopped altogether to grasp his existence in himself. Thinking is much too airy for this. But anything else that is within him, he will at most find in the way in which the external realms of nature are found in the natural sciences. And that is where modern man then looks for reality, existence. And he believes in himself only insofar as he is nature. As a result, nature, with its reality, becomes the Moloch, the god demanding human sacrifice, who is really depriving modern man of his sense of reality, of being in existence. There will no doubt be many people who say that they do not feel any of this, that it is not so. But that is just one opinion. The feelings of people today, those who are even just beginning to practice a bit of self-reflection, really arise wholly from the mood I have been describing. Modern man is encapsulated in this kind of experience of his own essential nature and his relationship to the surrounding world. He then applies the things he discovered in that encapsulation to his awareness of the world, looking at the stars through his instruments, for instance, the spectroscope, the telescope. He notes down what he sees there and makes it into a purely spatial astronomy, astrophysics, and so on. He does not realize that he has actually just taken up to the heavens something which he has observed and calculated in and for things on Earth. If I have a source of light here, everyone will agree that when I have gone many thousand miles away from that light source, the light out there in space will have grown weak, or may perhaps no longer be visible. Everyone knows that the luminosity of the light decreases with distance. A law of physics also says that gravity decreases to the square of the distance. Yet people do not take the thought any further. That gravity has a certain value here on Earth and decreases to the square of the distance is something people understand because we live here on Earth, establish laws of nature, fathom Earth truths, and connect them. They are true where gravity has a particular value. Gravity decreases, and so do the truths. Something that holds true on Earth ceases to be true as we follow its spread in the cosmos. We do not have the right to apply the physics and chemistry we establish here on Earth in simple analogy, just as we cannot apply the values for gravity on Earth and in its immediate surroundings to the cosmos. We must not consider the truth that pertains to the spheres of heaven to be the same as the truth we know here on Earth. We know that this is something enormously paradoxical, indeed fantastic, for modern people to hear. But that is how it is at the present time. The encapsulation of general conscious awareness has grown so powerful that a paradox must result as soon as we make the least pinprick in the capsule with something we say. It is in connection with all these things that human beings are really completely bound to the earth today, so that none of their insights, and often not even their reflections, can go beyond the things they experience on earth. And they do the same thing with cosmic time as they do with cosmic space. You see, I have often been discussing these particular truths in anthroposophical circles, and what I am going to say now is repeating this, using a single example. This was particularly evident when I was invited by our English anthroposophical friends to give a course of lectures in Penmanmar in the second half of August. This is in Wales, where Angsley Island lies near the west coast of Britain. It is indeed a quite remarkable region, a region which shows that there really are also geographies all over the globe which differ from those found in ordinary schoolbooks, even the schoolbooks at a higher level. People consider it quite advanced today to include the nature of the vegetation, the fauna and flora, when describing the geography of a place, and still base themselves on the geology, paleontology of the rocks, and so on. But there are much more inward differentiations across the globe than those commonly used for the geology of our Earth. In Penmanmar, where the lecture course was given, you take a few steps, as it were, 1 to 1.5 hours into the mountains, and you'll everywhere find the remnants of the ancient Druid rites, decayed stone structures of a simple kind. Thus, stones have been put together to enclose something of a small chamber with a covering stone. There, sunlight was excluded in a makeshift way, so that it would be dark inside. It cannot be denied that those cromlechs also served as burial places, for the most important ritual sites have always been built above the graves of others. Here, however, we have something entirely different as well. Also with these simple cromlechs, and this is evident from what we called the Druid circles. It was really very beautiful to see, when I went up one such mountain near Penmanmar, where the sparse remnants of two Druid circles may still be seen today, lying close together. The stones were positioned in such a way that one can see today that there have once been 12 of them. And someone who wants to see what this was all about will look and see that what mattered was this. As the sun followed its course in the cosmos, be it in the course of a day, be it in the course of a year, it would always cast its shadow in a particular way, one way of one stone, another of another. Watching how the shadow changed in the course of the day or the year, one was able to follow the course of the sun. People are sensitive to light today, particularly if the light is also bearing warmth, or the warmth is bearing light. Even today, human minds register the difference between sunlight in summer and sunlight in winter, because one feels hot in summer and cold in winter. People also note more subtle differences. But the differences in the light that one notes, because one is cold or hot, can also be seen in the shadow. It is not the same if it is the October, July, or August sun which casts the shadow, not only where the shadow is concerned, but also in inner quality. It was one of the tasks of the Druid priest to be able to perceive the quality of the shadow, that strange addition, one might say, of a reddish tone in the August shadow, a bluish tone to the November or December shadow. Their training enabled the Druid priests to read the daily path of the sun in the shadow. They could read the annual path of the sun in the shadow. It is still evident from these remnants today that one of the tasks undertaken there was of that nature. Many other things were part of the ritual, a sun worship that was not some kind of abstraction, not even the abstraction of mere devotion and humility. It would be absolutely wrong to think so, though this is no reason to underestimate devotion and humility. But here it was not abstract devotions and abstract humility which mattered, but there was something else as well to the ritual. You see, the grain of wheat, the seed of rye, needs to be buried in the ground at a specific time of the year. It is not good if they are put in the ground at the wrong time. Someone who knows these things very well will know that it matters if seed is sown a few days sooner or later. And there are also other things in human life, the life of the people who once lived in the geographical area where the Druids performed their rites, perhaps 3 millennia ago. Life was no doubt extraordinarily simple, with agriculture and animal husbandry the main activities. But let us ask ourselves, how were they to know when to sow and to harvest in the right way, when many other things needed to be done, which were connected with developments in the natural world through the year? People will say that today country people have their farmers' calendars, which tell them that this is the day for doing such and such, and this the day for such and such. These things are quite brilliant. Yes, we are living in an age when the human mind is such that these things are recorded, and one can read them in print. It does not occur to one that one is getting them from the printed page. That is how it is. But at the time when Druid worship was at its height, people did not have anything like this, not even the most primitive beginnings of reading and writing. But what they did have was that the priest could stand in such a Druid circle and observe its shadows. According to the shadow, he would say that for the next week the countryman should do this or that. The bull has to be taken through the herd, for that will be the right time for servicing the cows. People read in the cosmos and had the device that allowed them to do so. They would stand on the earth, and in order to do what needed to be done on earth, they would read what the sun itself told in the signs produced in those stone circles, of which only sparse remnants remain. That was a very different state of the human soul, and it would be serious arrogance of people today who can read and write a bit, to underestimate the art involved in establishing the actions and devices thanks to such heavenly revelations. I would say that in those sites, one is compelled to recall also many other things which spiritual science permits us to investigate. I have, on various occasions, said among anthroposophists, that everything which needs to be investigated using spiritual science cannot really be thought in ordinary thoughts. We have to think in images. I hope you all know what I have said about images, imaginations, in my book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds. This was disputed this morning, but I think that it does not apply to those present. One must always have these visions in images in the soul, when speaking of something observed directly in the spirit and not with the physical senses. The actual spiritual scientific descriptions given from this place here or in the Landhausstraße in Stuttgart were based on such imaginations. But they are much more alive than our mere abstract thoughts. It simply is the nature of abstract thoughts that one grasps not a trace of reality, but only images of reality in such thoughts. You touch and feel imaginations with your active thinking, just as you would touch and feel tables and chairs. When one gains insight, not in abstract concepts, but in imaginations, one is filled with reality, existence, in a much more robust way. Someone speaking out of imaginations always has them before him as if he were writing them down. But this is not writing with those cruelly abstract letters we use in writing, but in cosmic images. Well now, how is it with these imaginations in our region? Those who are familiar with it will know that it is relatively easy to arrive at these imaginations here, that they are relatively easy to produce. If one is conscientious, aware of one's responsibility, which one must always be aware of when saying anything at all that comes from spiritual science, one will, of course, also allow such an imagination to stand, that is, write it down in the script, for uttering them is merely the uttering of what is written, if one has turned it over many times, has tested and checked it many times over. Speaking out of the spiritual world with a full sense of responsibility does not make the words come easily from one's lips. Yet it is possible to say that in regions such as ours, such imaginations are written down with relative ease, but they will just as easily erase themselves. For someone who produces spiritual subject matter in imaginations, one cannot call it anything else. In our region, it is as if you write and then immediately erase what has been written. It is quickly erased. In that other region where sea and land meet, ebb and flood come every day, where the wind goes right through you, we not only felt the wind come in through the window in the hotel where we stayed on the ground floor, but we walked across the carpet as if on the billows of the sea, with the wind passing through underneath the carpet. It really did go right through one, and the whole of nature there is so much astir, joyfully stirred, that cloudbursts often alternate with sunshine, hour by hour. There you are in a natural world full of joyful life, and literally cannot help yourself but then also remember how this natural world revealed itself to the Druid priests of old. I might also call them Druid scholars, it is one and the same thing, when they looked down on it from their elevated seat. What did the earth look like to the Druid priest's inner eye, EYE, since the heavens appeared to be as I have just described? It is most interesting to observe. But one only arrives at the complete memory if one now understands the particular geographical differentiation in that place. There it takes a much greater effort to create the imaginations, much more than here, for instance. They do not easily inscribe themselves in the astral atmosphere, as it were. But they persist for a long time, are fixed, do not erase so quickly. We now come to see why the Druid priests sought out those particular places for their rites, for their more important rites, where the spiritual principle approaching the human being has marked features thanks to the nature of the place. Those very Druid circles which we visited there, if one had moved up into the air in a balloon, looking down from above on the smaller and the larger circle, they were at some distance, but if one was high enough, it would not have been so apparent. The two circles would have looked like the ground plan of the burned-out Gertianum. It is most beautifully situated. As you walk up the mountain, there are many places from where you have great views of mountain and sea. Then you reach the top. These Druid circles are in a large depression in the mountain, so that you find yourself surrounded by mountains, and the Druid circles are in this depression. That is where the Druid priest would look for wisdom, as he knew it, for knowledge and insight. That is where he looked for his sun wisdom and also wisdom relating to nature. Having thus entered into the whole complex of what existed on earth and what came down from heaven, the priest found something very different in the growth of plants, the growth of all vegetation, from what it has come to be to people of later times, people who thought in abstracts. When sun nature has been grasped by considering, on the one hand, the sense perceptible rays of the sun, which enter into the eye, EYE, and on the other hand the shadow, with its many differentiations, then you know that the spiritual sun lives on in the differentiation of the shadow. Shadow cast on other bodies only keeps away the physical side of the sun's rays. The spiritual side comes through. In the Cromlechs, as described, was a dark inner space that had been closed off in a makeshift way. Only the physical sunlight does not enter, but the influences do enter. And thanks to these influences, the Druid priest grew into a state of being inwardly filled with the secret powers of cosmic existence, into the secrets of the world. He came to see, for instance, the work which the sun did on the plant. He would see how this plant thrives at this time of the year, when the sun's influence is of a particular kind. He followed the sun in its spirituality, how it flows, pours into flower, leaf, root, and so on. He followed the influence of the sun as it was or is on animals. being able to gain inner insight into the son's actions in this aspect, he also came to see how other influences in the cosmos, like the moon influences, for example, poured into those sun influences. He then said to himself, quote, "The sun's influence on the plant brings shooting, sprouting life, something that wants to go on and on," close quote. The Druid priest knew that when a plant, growing from the soil, was exposed only to the sun, it would grow to infinity. The sun wants shooting, sprouting life. It is due to the moon influences, which are not only in the sunlight reflected back from the moon, that this life is held up, configured, that leaves, flower, fruit, and seed assume a specific form, that the striving for infinity is set many kinds of limits. The moon reflects all influences, and these are given off in the quality that grows upward from the root, lives in animal reproduction, and so forth. Let us take a particular case. The Druid priest looked at the growing plant. He saw how the plant grew. He saw, in a living way, the principle that Goethe was to follow later in a more abstract way in his title Metamorphosis. He would see the sun powers streaming down, and also the reflected powers of the sun in the element that configures the plant. In his natural science, he saw sun and moon working together in every single plant, every single animal. He knew what sun and moon did to the root, which is still down in the ground, and has to depend on absorbing the salts of the earth in a particular way. Sun and moon do something very different in the leaf, which comes away from the ground and stretches out into the air. And he would see something else again in the flower, which comes away from the earth and strives toward the light of the sun. He would see them as one, sun influence and moon influence, mediated through the earth's influence. Plant growth, animal nature, he would see it all together in one. He was, of course, living there in the way in which we also did live there, with stormy winds all around, which tell one so much of the configuration of the region, of those peculiar, beautiful gifts of the weather that are full of life. On one occasion, when a Eurythmy performance started in a hall built of wood, people were sitting under their umbrellas because a cloudburst had immediately preceded the event and was still continuing when the Eurythmy started. The curtains were getting quite wet. Being so closely bound up with the weather is something you can still experience very well in that place, and the Druid priest did as well, of course. Nature was not so standoffish. It embraced one then and still does so today. You are, I'd say, truly, it is something extraordinarily nice, almost attracted by the activities of nature. They are by your side. You feel yourself to be part of them. I actually met people who thought that you even don't have to eat properly there. Eating goes of its own accord within that natural world. So the Druid priest would stand in that natural world, but with the whole of his sun initiation, and see what I have described: sun, moon, mediated by the earth's activities, plant growth, growth of root, leaves, and flowers, and all of it not in the kind of abstract natural laws we know today, but in living elemental spirits. Different elemental spirits are active in the root, different sun elementals, different moon elementals from those in leaf and flower. The Druid priest also knew how to find the things that live in beneficent boundaries, in root, leaf, and flower, in the far horizons of nature. Having the gift of imagination, he saw the small elemental spirits held in close confinement in the root. He knew that something which was beneficent in the root could emancipate and grow to giant size. He, therefore, saw the great events in nature as the small natural processes in the plant grown to giant size. As he had spoken of elemental spirits living in the root, so he would speak of the root spirits, which had grown further in a way that was cosmically wrong, and become visible in the development of hoarfrost, dew, and hail. He would speak of root spirits working in a beneficent way, and of ice and frost giants, which were the same as root spirits grown to giant size in nature. He spoke of the small-scale activities of elementals in the leaf, as they fill themselves with the principle that is active in the air. And he would also trace this to the far horizons of nature, and speak of the way in which the principle that lives in the plant leaf may become emancipated, and seek to go beyond the boundaries of beneficence into the far reaches of nature, to embrace the principle that is born on the waves of the wind. The wind and storm giants are the plant leaf's elementals grown large. The principle in the flower that boils up toward the light of the sun, producing the volatile oils which are phosphoric by nature, when that is emancipated, it turns into the fire giants. Loki belonged to that race of giants. With his sun and moon science, the druid priest would see as one the quality that lived in the confined space of the plant and the emancipated power that lived in wind and weather. He would go further than that, however. He would say to himself, quote, held within the beneficent boundaries set by the good gods, it unfolds normal plant growth. When it shows itself in frost and ice, it is the product of the gods' enemies. Having grown beyond the set boundaries, the elemental spirits have become enemies of the gods and changed over into the devastating, harmful elements in nature. As a human being, I can take in the devastating activities of the gods' enemies. I can therefore gather in the frost and the ice, the powers that ride on the wings of the storm, and all that can be captured on the waves of the wind or in the rain. I can use it for the things I prepare. By using the powers of the giants, burning the plant and reducing it to ash, to coal, and so on, I take the powers of the giants and use the powers of the frost, the hail, the raindrops, and other such things, and the forces of the fire giants to protect normal plant growth. I rob the plants of all these things so that I may treat the normal plant with it, make medicines from the plants which are kept in their normal boundaries by the beneficent elementals, by treating them with the powers of these enemies of the gods. Close quote. That was one of the methods of making plants into medicines, using frost, using what lives in snow and ice formations, using what could be achieved by means of combustion or calcination, and so on. The druid priest thus felt himself to be the one who took the harmful principles from the enemies of the gods, the giants, and took it back again to serve the good gods. This is how we can follow up these things in many different ways. Why do we follow these things up? Because we want to be clear in our minds in using this example. I am giving it as an example because I feel that the course given in Penman Mar must indeed count as a most important event in the history of the anthroposophical movement. To show that, relatively speaking, not all that long ago, the whole state of the human soul was very different from what it is today. Today people are in a state of mind which absolutely cannot enter into the minds of those earlier peoples. And what I have said about those earlier people could be said about other peoples. We are gaining insight into a completely different state of soul. Those people did not yet have the feeling for the abstract thoughts we have today. All their thinking was still more dreamlike. They did not live in the sharply defined concepts and ideas in which we live today. They were really living in much more lively, rich, saturated dreams, and also in their waking hours as if in a continuation of their dreams. This dreaming, never coming wholly awake, alternated, just as our waking hours today with the abstract ideas of the waking state alternate with dreaming and sleep. Theirs alternated with dreamless sleep. Their dreamless sleep was not as we know it today. When the human being came awake for his dream-like daytime life, he would feel, quote, "Something by way of sleep lives in me, even when I am awake. It is something which fills me like inner food for the soul, which I have taken in during sleep. It makes itself felt in me. I even have the taste of it within me." Close quote. People then still had the aftertaste of sleep in the whole of their organism. A third state was deeper than our sleep today, a state no longer experienced in the human mind. That third state was the state of being embraced by the earth, so that on waking the human being would feel, quote, "I have not just been sleeping. Apart from being asleep, of which I have an aftertaste, I was received by the forces of earth's gravity into a kind of nighttime grave. Earth's gravity covered me. I was embraced by the earth." Close quote. We can say that today human beings know three states of consciousness, waking, dreaming, sleeping. And therefore we have to say that at a particular time in the past, people knew the states of dreaming, sleeping, being embraced by the earth. Everything that evolves in the course of history is connected to a degree, also at the present time. Because of this, some human souls will have something unusual arise within them in a later life on earth, something like a real memory of earlier times connected with their earlier life on earth. This memory, which begins to shine out in such people, something abnormal in their own time, is like a living memorial in the soul. One such spirit was Jacob Burma, another Swedenborg. Something connected with the evolution of humanity shines into humanity of more recent times, from a far distant past. Tomorrow I will speak of the inner nature of Jacob Burma and of Swedenborg so that we may understand the human past and the three states of awareness which human beings will have in the future. The end of Lecture 6.